are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, November 12th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, MSNBC reporter Erin Carmon on her book, Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Also on the program today, why the Fifth Circuit loss in Texas for DAPA, the deferred action of parents for parents of Americans executive order, is actually good for President Obama, or at the very least, the timing's good for Obama and those impacted by that executive order. Meanwhile, Chris Christie, hot off his showing up at a debate, blames President Obama for racism on campuses, basically. Also on the program, a Utah judge denies a lesbian foster parent's, or I should say, takes an infant away from a lesbian foster parent's. Right-wing white supremacist terrorists arrested. You won't read much about that. Apparently, being white is just one of the worst ideas in the world. Also on the program, more pushback on that Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or anti-Consumer Financial Protection Bureau ad. We will talk about that and the report that there will be 100 million new people living in poverty by 2030 as a function of climate change. All that and more on today's program. First off, new polls out today showing that Hillary Clinton is basically maintaining her lead over Bernie Sanders. 52% of primary voters is in a CBS poll, as opposed to Sanders, 33%. That's a national poll, obviously. I mean, this is really, really annoying, but I'm going to tell you something that you probably have not been aware of. I mean, maybe some of you, but most of you are not aware of this. And I think I knew at one point the dates, but I didn't realize it was coming up. And it's just indicative of what is a problem. And I, back at the end of August, I think it was around, it was the last week of August, I was on MSNBC arguing with Jess McIntosh, who I like and who I generally agree with, that the Democratic Party had obviously scheduled and limited debates as a way to help Hillary Clinton, because it is as old as politics itself that the front runner or the incumbent, either or, benefits from the least amount of debates, frankly, the least amount of exposure. And it's one thing for a candidate to say, I'm not going to go out there and expose myself that much. But it's another for a party to limit the debates, to promote one candidacy over another. So I know many of you are going to be surprised to hear that there is another Democratic debate this weekend, Saturday night. Of course, why wouldn't you do it on a Saturday night? That's always the night that you want to check out a Democratic debate, or any debate for that matter. Designed specifically so that it will get the least amount of tension possible. It is in Des Moines. Of course, Iowa's the site of the first primary, or I should say caucus in this case. But just stunning. Just a stunning... to me, it also looks like Democrats are trying to run away from things. And it does a disservice to the party. It does a disservice to our politics. And frankly, on some level, it does a disservice to all the candidates, and even the ones who will benefit from the least amount of exposure, in this case, Hillary Clinton, because it gives her one less opportunity to sell herself to the primary electorate. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders, on the, just days from the debate to be held in Des Moines, Iowa, got a major union endorsement on Thursday. The American Postal Workers Union announced its backing of Bernie Sanders last night. I think that's the biggest union that is supporting Bernie Sanders. And it's a big union. It's not the teachers union, but it's damn big. And the union president, Mark Diamondstein, said in the announcement backing Bernie Sanders, "We should judge candidates not by their political party, not by what they say, not by what we think they stand for, but what they do. No other candidate has his record of fighting to defend and expand Social Security, promoting Medicare for all, and opposing fast-track trade authority and rotten deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership," the union president said. So congratulations to Bernie Sanders. I will watch the debate this weekend, but I don't know if you will. I hope you will, but we will see.
Record it to watch later or watch it live?
I will probably record it and then watch it like an hour later.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
We'll see what time the kids go to bed. Michael. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Erin Carmen about her book, Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Erin Carmon. She is the she's a MSNBC reporter and the author, or I should say co-author, of Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And here I go, Erin. I'm going to attempt to pronounce your co-author's name, Shana Knizhnik. Did I get that right?
That was perfect.
That is shocking, as I rarely pronounce anything correctly. So, all right, let's start with. I just love the idea of a Supreme Court justice becoming a hero again, because I feel like, at least on the left, I imagine Scalia is sadly, I can imagine there are people with a picture of Scalia in their house or in their bedroom right now, which is a little bit disturbing. But it seems to me that there has not been a liberal justice icon, maybe since Marshall. Just give me a sense of where this began, at least in terms of this notion of notorious RBG.
It all started on a week where the Supreme Court brought down decisions that gutted important civil rights legislation. There were three historic dissents from Justice Ginsburg. Traditionally, Supreme Court justices and the majority reads their dissent from the bench. What's less traditional is for someone to read a dissent from the bench. That shows that they're really pissed off. And in the week of June 2013 that the notorious RBG was born, Justice Ginsburg read her dissent from the bench three times in an affirmative action case, in a case involving discrimination and employment, and maybe the biggest and most significant, and for liberals, the most outrageous case, was the Voting Rights Act being gutted.
Right. This is Shelby v. Holder, and we've talked about that ruling many times, both at the time that it came down, but also all the implications that have followed from it, where the court struck down the formula, essentially, which kept about 13 states in preclearance, or I should say counties in preclearance, to change their voting rules.
Absolutely. And Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, said that throwing out preclearance when it had worked to stop discriminatory changes was like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. And that, in fact, was the first quote on Notorious RBG, the Tumblr, started by my co-author, Shana Knizhnik. And she was just applauding Justice Ginsburg's fighting spirit, even in loss. And it became a place to celebrate her. Even before she got to the Supreme Court, she was a civil rights hero. But suddenly, as the leader of the liberal wing at a time where the Supreme Court was lurching to the right and really undermining a lot of important civil rights legislation, it was a moment to say, here, she's pretty notorious. Even though she's been known her entire life for being kind of a quiet, soft-spoken person, she's making her voice heard in a revolutionary way.
And in terms of her style, and we'll get into sort of the theory of change, as it were, but the idea of this public of a... this public of a dissent was both unique in the context of the Supreme Court, but also unique in the context of her work as a justice.
Absolutely. I mean, she's somebody who traditionally has wanted to shape the majority opinion. She doesn't like losing. I mean, Justice Scalia now is known for very biting dissents in which he insults others. Justice Ginsburg prefers not to take cheap shots. But I think, you know, post-2006, in particular after Justice Alito joined the court and replaced Sandra Day O'Connor, someone she'd really been able to work with, there was no longer any choice but to dissent.
I mean, let's talk. That's a good place to start with that. I mean, let's talk about. Let's go back and talk a little bit about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's history before we get into to other things. She was in many respects a trailblazer at different points in her career. Right. I mean, she was one of the first female professors to get tenure at Rutgers.
She was the second one at Rutgers and the first woman to get tenure at Columbia Law School. But she, you know, before she got there, she was somebody who had numerous doors slammed in her face because at various points, as she put it, she was a woman, a mother, and a Jew. So when she got to Harvard Law School as one of only 9 women in her class, she was ushered into a dinner by the dean who asked each one of the women, how do you justify taking the place of a man? When she graduated, tied for first in her class.
So wait a second, I want to hear more about that dinner. I mean, so the dean of the school, was the dean upset that they were there or just felt like that they needed to be able to articulate how they justified that? And I'm curious as to, like, did she recount that, what everyone said around the table?
So she always kind of faults herself for never having the witty line at the right time, ironically. And so what she said is that she stood up and mumbled that, first of all, she was a chain smoker and she had an ashtray on her lap. So she stood up and the ashtray scattered all over the floor of the dean's house. So she was humiliated. And then she mumbled, because her husband was also at Harvard Law School, you know, I thought I should come to law school so I would understand my husband's work better.
Oh, geez. That must have, was she being sarcastic or was it one of those things where she just couldn't believe that she was being asked that? I mean,
just couldn't believe she was being asked that, and she just wanted to, like, fall into a trap door on the floor. And she also, you know, she said that she wished she'd had the wherewithal to say what one of her classmates said, which is to sarcastically say, I came to Harvard Law School to catch a man.
Nice. Well, all right, so, I mean, give me a sense of, like, at what point, right? I mean, she goes through these type of experiences. And that's just the first of one there. When she taught at Rutgers, there's a story about what she was told in terms of what she would earn. Tell that story.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that question. Do you mind repeating that?
Yeah. When she was at Rutgers, she was told how much she should earn, right? There was a story behind that as well.
Well, I think at every point in her life, she was underestimated and sold short and denied opportunities just because she was a woman. So when she got to Rutgers, she was told, well, you know, we can't possibly pay you what a man would make because your husband has a good job. And a little while later, she got pregnant by surprise and was afraid that because she didn't have tenure at the time, that she would not get her contract renewed. Because 10 years earlier, when she got pregnant for the first time, she was demoted and then forced out of her job. So determined not to make that mistake again, she borrowed baggy clothes from her mother-in-law and hid her pregnancy, which luckily she was able to give birth during the summer. But later on, she ended up filing a class action lawsuit, being part of a class action lawsuit against Rutgers, in which they got a settlement and back pay. And later when she got to Columbia, she also helped the women of Columbia University sue the university for its systematic discrimination against women. So in her early years of life, you kind of see her just accepting the way things were. But right around the late 60s, early 70s, the world starts changing, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg's really inspired by that. And that's when she starts fighting back and using her gigantic brain and insane work ethic for the cause of justice for more people.
I mean, because what I'm curious about is, you know, and maybe it was just a question of like sort of an innate sense that may have remained sort of subdued. In other words, here she is as a young, as a kid deciding, like, I'm going to go to law school or I'm going to, you know, and, you know, and I know you've written she was very much inspired by her mom, who I guess passed away just as she had graduated high school. But I mean, did she already have these sort of notions of equality in a social sense as opposed to just like a confidence in herself? Or was her experiences, or how much was it her experiences as she's going through these situations? The dean says, what are you guys doing? You know, justify why you're here. A boss saying, you know, you don't need to make so much because your husband's making money. What is the relationship between where she was that got her into those situations and then how those situations influenced her perspective? Both, I guess, from a social perspective and then ultimately from a legal perspective.
Well, I think she was long a liberal. That was shaped by the fact that the Cold War was happening while she was at Cornell, and there were people that she was close to who were blacklisted or stigmatized for being having been interested in Marxism in the past. So I think she had a really strongly developed feeling of justice. She has also talked about being traumatized by learning that World War II, which she thought of as a war against racism, was in the end, the United States segregated troops. So I think that she was aware of those kinds of political issues, but she didn't see the intimate sphere or the way she had been treated as anything that you could push back against. But I think the seeds were really sown in Sweden, where she ended up going throughout the 60s to study civil procedure, to study a pretty dry, esoteric legal field that she excelled in, and which was what she originally taught at Rutgers. And at that point, there was a debate happening in Sweden about men and women's roles. You know, of course, liberals always like to say they can do it in Sweden. You know, Sweden has years-long paternity leave and great social insurance. Well, all of that was starting to happen at the time in Sweden. Had she not gone there, maybe the country would look very different. She was really influenced by the Swedish feminists and the debates that they were having challenging gender stereotypes. And so all of that groundwork, her own experiences, her exposure to the debate in Sweden conspired to the fact that when her students, who were kind of 60s radicals and had been in the civil rights movement, when they came to her in the late 60s and said, "Will you teach a class on women and the law?" She was ready. And I think that's when, and also when she started doing litigation work at the ACLU, and there were hundreds of letters from women who were protesting their treatment because of their gender, whether it was because they were pregnant or just because they were women in a male-dominated field, that's when she really started to see, wait, this is not just me. This is systematic. And she thought the only way to fix this is to fundamentally change the way the Constitution is interpreted. You had to go big. And so that's when she co-founded the ACLU's Women's Rights Project and launched an incredibly successful 10-year-long campaign to transform the understanding of the Constitution.
And she her perspective was not just a question of like, and I don't want to say this, you know, I don't want to be too narrow in this, but narrowly changing, or I should say a narrow field of law per se. But it seems to me that based upon her perspective of, she also had this sort of element, I guess, where she saw the emancipation of men in some way as also being intricate to this broad social project. So it wasn't just a question of changing certain aspects of the law, but the types of cases that she brought, in some instances, representing men, was just as important. Sort of like, I mean, how would you describe that?
Well, I think her time in Sweden had given her an understanding of the fact that gender norms held back everybody, and that until men and women weren't weighed down by the expectations that women would be in private life and caregivers, and men would be in making the decisions in public life and breadwinners and political actors, until men and women were both freed from that, there would be no change, because it wasn't really enough to just give women a shot at male-dominated fields. That really wouldn't change very much, because there was still going to be an entire other realm of the world that was going to be transformed. And I think part of the reason she was so optimistic about men and women being partners is that in her own life, her marriage was unusually equal, particularly for a marriage that happened in the 1950s. Her husband, Marty Ginsburg, was a great partner of hers, also a brilliant attorney who made lots of money and was super successful, but also promoted her career and held down the home front at various stages. So when she brought cases, in fact, one of the cases she brought with him as co-counsel, that challenged the way the law treated men who wanted to care for their elderly mothers or men who wanted to be the primary caregivers to their children, but the law treated their work as lesser, it was the other side of the coin as saying that women in the military demanded were entitled to the same benefits, or that women couldn't be treated as lesser entities when it came to choosing juries that were making important decisions for the country.
Talk a little bit about I'm curious too as to about those cases on that other side of the coin, because I think, you know, there's I think some of this stuff, and particularly also there's other obviously other cases too, that in terms of just where women's rights stood in terms of being able to be on juries, and that I think are so hard for people to imagine that we're talking about, you know, 30, 40 years ago on some of this stuff. It just sounds like, you know, when you hear the nature of these cases, that I think a lot of people imagine, oh, this must have been from the 1800s or, you know, from the Middle Ages or something.
Right, right. Well, I mean, it was still as late as the 60s, completely constitutional, for a woman to be tried by a jury for killing her husband, that in a state that automatically exempted women from jury duty, and that required, you know, if women wanted to volunteer, they could be on a trial. But that was completely upheld because, this is, again, 1966, the majority opinion said women are still the center of home and family life. You know, and so she wanted to upend the kind of paternalism in the law. And what she was up against was the feeling that this was a favor to women, like, oh, you wouldn't want to worry your pretty head about that. So she actually stood before the justices in several cases and said, you know, you have to count women as equal under the law. And that means having the good and the bad of civic responsibilities. And, you know, there's this quote that she says, that shows up in one of the opinions that was originally in her brief, where she says, you know, what was perceived as a pedestal is actually a cage. And she audaciously quoted the abolitionist feminist Sarah Grimke in front of 9 male Supreme Court justices, and she said, "We ask for no special favor from our brethren. We only ask that they take their feet off our necks."
Tell us who Polly Murray was and what she has to do with Ginsburg.
So this is one of our favorite characters that we really, I'm so glad you asked about that, because we really want more people to know about Polly Murray's story. And in fact, Polly Murray was an attorney who worked in the civil rights struggle, who potentially today, you know, we don't know how she would have identified in today's terms. She was a black woman and today would be maybe gender queer, maybe trans, maybe a lesbian. She had tried to change her sex way before this was something that the medical establishment was paying any attention to. But as a co-founder of the National Organization for Women and as a legal activist, she helped craft the legal strategy that Justice Ginsburg convinced the Supreme Court to make law. And Justice Ginsburg has a very finely attuned sense of history. She's very interested in giving credit. So she, in her very first brief to the Supreme Court, her first chance to shine, she actually listed Polly Murray and another feminist pioneer, Dorothy Kenyon, as the co-authors of this brief, even though they hadn't actually written the words in the brief. But she wanted to say, we're standing on their shoulders. The world wasn't ready to listen in the 30s, 40s, and 50s when they were working. And in the 60s, but now in the 70s, social movements have changed the world enough, and we want to show that we learned from them, and we want them to have credit.
I mean, I don't know if people can really appreciate how, I guess, unique that is in the context of someone. I mean, I guess sort of generically, people can understand the idea of like you have a first-time opportunity to do something, and you want to garner the credit, but that's just not something that happens when people go in front of the Supreme Court and credit people who probably weren't even conscious necessarily that it would even be contemplated that they would get credit for that brief.
Right, and I think a lot of the current debates that are sort of tearing apart progressive circles and in feminist circles, a lot of it does come down to the feeling of limited resources and giving credit. And I think there's a lot to learn from this gesture of saying, you know, it doesn't take anything away from my work to say that I really learned from other people and I want them to get the credit that they deserve. I think that goes a long way.
Let's talk about her time on the Supreme Court, and broadly speaking, let's talk about her strategy, because you know, in talking about Ginsburg, people, I think in the book there's various people who have commented that, you know, if she had come in a sort of a different package in some way, or had lived her life differently, her ideas would be perceived, because of her ideas, she'd be perceived much more of a radical than people give her credit for. Tease that out for us.
Well, you know, it's interesting. She was working at the ACLU in the 70s with a lot of folks who were heating up. They were all heated up about changing the world. And here comes this woman. She's very properly dressed, and she's married with children, and she lives on the Upper East Side, and she speaks very quietly and slowly, and she wants to be very deliberate about the legal strategy. So at the time, people, mostly men, said, oh, well, you know, she's just an establishment person. But I think if you look at the full force of her ideas, the idea that women deserved full access to a range of reproductive freedoms, that men and women, their roles could be transformed and they could be in partnership, a lot of these ideas are still unrealized. And one of her friends who we interviewed told us, you know, had she not come in looking like almost like a Trojan horse, then people would have just said, oh, you're a total radical. I mean, let's just stop and think about the fact that we have, you know, the phrase card-carrying member of the ACLU was right. So stigmatized in the last few decades. She was a co-director of the ACLU Women's Rights Project. She's on the Supreme Court. And I think, you know, some of that is luck of timing, and it's certainly never going to happen again. But some of it just had to do with the fact that her presentation was intentionally unthreatening. Her personality was such that she kind of snuck in while they weren't really paying attention.
And I mean, give me a sense of her perspective on economics. I mean, because on some level, I've heard many critics of the Supreme Court talk about the liberals on the court. You know, and maybe this was a couple years ago. So, although I would imagine in many respects it still stands, that the liberals on the court. When it comes to sort of more questions of corporations or of questions of the state versus citizens, where does she fit on that spectrum? And we should also say that part of where she sits on that spectrum is also a function of the right-wing, almost radicalism, I think, of at least the court's majority now, right? Because that's going to dictate some of the cases that are brought up in front of the court and sort of the broader direction of where it's going. But give us a sense of where she is on those fronts.
Well, she's a liberal through and through. I think to the extent that people, you know, say that even the liberals on the Supreme Court are not that liberal and it's just that the court has gone to the right, in her case, a lot of that has to do with her views on the role of the court versus the role of the legislature. You know, she is very aware of the risk of backlash to some people to a fault. So she believes that the role of the court should be deferential to legislatures. Now, it just so happens that a lot of the cases brought to the Supreme Court these days are brought by conservative activists who are looking to undermine legislatively enacted laws, such as, you know, Obamacare, the Voting Rights Act, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So, you know, judicial activism is very much in the eye of the beholder. In terms of the most important decisions involving the rights of corporations, you know, Justice Ginsburg has said that if she could overturn any decision of modern vintage, it would be Citizens United. She very specifically said, I think the notion that we have all the democracy that money can buy strays so far from what our democracy is supposed to be. And she said that's number one of what she would overturn. And there have been a lot of decisions she disagreed with. You know, she also objected to the extension of corporate rights presented by Hobby Lobby.
Mm-hmm.
Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act came out of a dissent from Justice Ginsburg in a case that involved people's access to the courts after they're discriminated against. So I think, you know, in terms of reining in the power of corporations either to stomp on workers or to spend a lot of money to distort the political process, I think she's made her voice pretty clear.
Talk about broadly about her, about that notion that she is takes an incrementalist approach in terms of attacking, I guess, these, you know, approaching an outcome with a deliberate and very incremental approach. And then I want to talk about Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, people are most familiar with this in terms of Roe v. Wade and her resistance to going too far too fast. This is also what characterized her litigation throughout the 70s. She was very concerned that if change went too far or not in the right path, that the backlash would undo all the hard-fought gains. She also thinks that the court should follow social change that's already happened in the world. So I think it would be incorrect to say that she thinks that all social change should be incremental. It's that she thinks the law should move incrementally. She thinks that social movements, you know, the women's rights movement that she always says that she was responding to and not creating, the LGBT rights movement, the way that it completely transformed people's understanding of the humanity of gays and lesbians, she thinks that's the prerequisite, is organizing culture change, and then the law follows, as opposed to using the law as the primary tool of social change.
Did she?
It needs to happen one step at a time.
I mean, did she? Was it from her perspective? Did, for instance, let's say the idea of marriage equality, did it follow? Did the court sort of like take that incremental approach? I mean, at some level, I guess it did, right? I mean, but it also, I don't know, the pace of things seemed to quicken.
Well, the pace did quicken, but there were two steps to that decision. In the United States versus Windsor case, they did strike down first the Defense of Marriage Act, but then the same year declined to strike down Prop 8, sent it back to the lower courts. So, you know, it took 2 years for them to revisit the issue of marriage equality. Justice Ginsburg has said that she thinks that it's because people have, because the LGBT rights movement has been so successful in showing people that these are our neighbors, these are our friends, these are us, that she doesn't think that it's moving too far too fast. Well, in the case of abortion.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was curious as to what. Let's talk about the you know, you were about to say in the case of the of abortion.
Well, I think to some extent this is personal for her. In 1972, when the court was about to hear Roe v. Wade for the second time, because it reheard it, she had a case that was pending before the court that was of an Air Force major, an Air Force nurse who had become pregnant while on active duty. And was Catholic, didn't want to have an abortion, wanted to take her sick leave to give birth and give the child up for adoption. But the military at that point, and this is amazing, this is before abortion was legal in the United States, the military had a policy that you could either get an abortion and stay, or you could leave base. So you had to choose between your pregnancy and your job. And the fact that this was a case of a woman who didn't want to have an abortion appealed to Justice Ginsburg's sort of counterintuitive surprise approach, maybe the same impulse that led her to bring men as plaintiffs. So she brought a case on behalf of this woman whose name was Susan Strzok, hoping that it would slowly lay the groundwork, just like her other cases had slowly laid the groundwork for a higher test for laws that discriminated against women, towards full reproductive freedom. Start out with a woman who doesn't want to get an abortion. Slowly build the case for the understanding that a woman's access to abortion is just one piece of her broader reproductive freedom, and that the state can't treat women like children. It can't make that decision for them, because this is their right to determine the course of their destiny.
So in other words, rather than fight it on privacy grounds, fight it on simply full-on
equality.
Sort of sovereignty grounds on some level, or I guess equality.
She wanted to fight it on equality grounds because she'd already been developing this doctrine of equality in her other cases. So her hope was that abortion wouldn't be separated from that. But, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth about this. I'm personally not persuaded that it really would have made much of a difference if Roe had been based in equality. There were equality arguments that were made at the time, but the 9 male justices of the Supreme Court weren't interested in them. And I think there's still something profoundly disruptive about the idea of a woman deciding who is born and who isn't. And so, you know, there is a counterfactual that says maybe we wouldn't have all this backlash and conflict. But I'm not sure that the women of Texas and Mississippi would have been better off if every state had had to, like, slowly liberalize all of its laws. I just think there's something profoundly disruptive to people about women's reproductive freedom.
Yeah, I mean, we should make that clear. When we're debating about this, there's two parts of that debate, right? One part of that debate is that would it have led to less backlash because it would have been handled on different grounds, and it would have been sort of from a legal standpoint, perhaps on more solid footing. But the other part of that argument too is that it would have maybe led to other principles, right? Where those principles become. Become sort of transferred into other parts of our law. I mean, off the top of my head, I can't come up with how that would play out necessarily. But
the hope was that things like the current ban that we have on federal Medicaid coverage of abortion, you know, if it's private, does the state have to pay for it? So I think, you know, Justice Ginsburg supported women's health care being treated like any other health care. So. The question is, you know, if it had been decided on equality grounds, would it potentially not have foreclosed on public funding? But I think the problem is, I mean, you know, to paraphrase Rumsfeld, you go to war with the court you have. And the court was not made up of 9 feminists who thought about economic justice. And so she's always been very clear. Her theory of change is that you have to meet people where they are and then slowly lead them down the path of where it is you want them to go.
What was her relationship with Sandra Day O'Connor? I mean, did O'Connor feel like she was passing some type of baton to Ginsburg?
I think, you know, even though they voted very differently on almost every issue, I think she and Sandra Day O'Connor had a real fellowship. They had both experienced a lot of discrimination. They took very different approaches to what they had gone through and to the law. But Justice Ginsburg was happy that there were women of all different points of view because she was so used to being the only woman in the room in law school, and she always felt like when she was called on that she had to stand up for all women. So even just the fact that they disagreed, I think, really appealed to her because it showed that women came in all different forms and all different ideologies.
Right, and they came from very different backgrounds.
Right. Sandra Day O'Connor was very much shaped by growing up on a ranch in Arizona. She was a sort of compromise-making, practical-minded Republican. Today, she would probably be considered a liberal by the vast majority of the Republican Party. I think they mostly backed off from her. I think she didn't experience quite the backlash that, say, Justice Souter experienced.
Right.
But the fact that Sandra Day O'Connor was replaced by Alito has been very bad news for progressives.
Right. And lastly, let's talk about just that dynamic. And it's a little bit moot right now, I guess, but maybe it's worth bringing up. There was at least a couple of years ago now when there was still a sense that perhaps I guess it was when the Democrats still controlled the Senate, that Ginsburg and frankly, I mean, I heard the same thing about Breyer, too, who's also had a history of health issues, should have resigned and given a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president the opportunity to appoint her successor. Give us a sense of why. Of what her thinking of it, and surely she was conscious of that chatter.
Sure, she directly responded to it a few times. One of the times she said, "I don't think that President Obama could appoint someone as liberal as me." I mean, I think while this is a very high stakes decision for progressives, who, if they're worried about the fate of the court, should definitely be organizing to make sure that there's someone in a position to nominate people that share their values. Justice Ginsburg's decision, I think, was very personal. It's about the fact that she loves her job. She wasn't ready to go. She's as sharp as she ever was. She just reached a position of seniority on the court where she's the most senior justice in the minority most of the cases. So she now has the ability to decide if she wants to write something or to assign an opinion to somewhere else. And she told me when I interviewed her in February, I'm going to continue doing the job until I feel myself slipping, as long as I can do the job full steam. She's perhaps more committed to her work than any other person I have ever spoken to or known of in my life. So I think her decision is purely based on the fact that she loves her job and she feels like she still has a lot of work left to go.
Isn't that weird, though? I mean, maybe weird's the wrong word. I mean, because She, it seems to me, more than anybody, would understand that this it may be a personal decision for me, but its broader implications are huge.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that ship has sailed.
Right. Yes.
With a Republican Senate now, at this point, it would just be second-guessing the past. And I think for, you know, for folks who want to be angry at her, you know, they can bang their heads against a wall, or they can go make sure that there's going to be a Democratic president to appoint as many as three justices.
Right. I know. It's still an interesting question to talk about, though.
Yeah, totally. Sam, it's been so awesome to spend time with you. I
know you
got to
run. All right, Aaron Carmone, the book is The Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Aaron, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Sam. Bye.
All right, folks. We were going long there. Well, not too long, right? Because we had a little bit of a hiccup, a tech hiccup earlier in the program. Ladies and gentlemen, want to remind you, it is your memberships that make this program possible. Oh, before we talk about that, we should do a little bit of house cleaning. This is going to be important for everybody. We're going to post, a lot of people have been asking, are you going to post the Republican debate audio? From the other night, the commentary, because we are unable to post the video. Now, as some of you know, we were shut down, or our YouTube stream was shut down by Fox Business, or Fox, probably News Corp, shut it down. And when they shut it down, we thought, okay, we sort of anticipated this. They had shut us down before. I strongly believe that we had every right to provide what we were providing. We were using their feed, but we were also commenting in real time, both visually and in terms of what we were saying. We were commenting in multiple ways, adding a different value to the product. And in some ways, depending on what your perspective was or what you enjoy, we were inhibiting its value for people who wanted to see it, you know, without sort of our messing with it, if you will. And so we were within fair use. Fox shut us down. Now, I wasn't surprised by this because they had done this before. And our feeling at the time was that's okay, because what we will do is we will post the video after the fact, because we had gone through this before and we record it both locally in addition to it being streamed. Now, at the end of the evening, however, we found that the video had appeared to have stopped recording locally at the same time that the stream had gone down. And that's the way it was until someone, now it seemed very suspicious that would happen, because that did not happen before. Michael was sitting at the computer and now your mic is up. His mic can stay up now that he's got the button.
Go ahead.
So you were sitting at the computer, correct?
That's right.
And you said,
I asked him to tell you exactly what happened.
Well, wait a second. Let me just tell what. Yeah. And so I said, Michael, did you touch anything? And you said, no.
No.
You said, correct. Absolutely not.
No.
And it was late, and I was very frustrated because, you know,
quite a little tantrum. Yes.
I didn't have that much of it.
No, it was like a 30 second.
Matt, did I have did I have a tantrum,
right,
or would I exclaim like some anger?
It was momentary frustration.
Right. Okay. Exactly. It's very frustrating. Spent a lot of time setting this up. Setting it up and it's not free. I mean, there's expense involved in all of this. The Slingbox unit to get the video, the pizza, the beer, the cars, I wore a tie I continued to wear a tie that night, which also very difficult by, you know, social expense. And so you denied that you had touched it. And it wasn't until the next day where we realized, wait a second, we can find out exactly what happened because we actually have the video.
We have the last 30 seconds.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And here it is. Now,
that's great.
We will include this in a video, but I'm now turning it towards Matt and Kelly and Michael. And we are now going to play the video to see exactly what happened in those last 30 seconds. We also have audio with it because there was, of course, was audio. And here it is. All right. So we have a multi-windowed shot here. You can see I'm up here in the corner wearing my tie. There's Michael, just, you know, who knows, texting somebody on... what's that? You going to shoot that? Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have to shoot that part because we're going to we'll include it in the video in a third window. But here we have Michael's, you know, sitting there on his computer, probably texting a friend or something, or setting up. What am I doing afterwards? Yo, what's up? Hit me with your deets or whatever it is.
Hit
you're
me
doing.
With the deets.
And who knows? And so here you can say at one point, because at one point I get an IM from a listener saying you're down on YouTube. So here it is. I'm going to let it roll.
Just cut our YouTube feed.
We freeze non-defense discretionary for 8 years.
Are you sure?
We also put an increase in defense.
Now, I'll just tell you what happened. I say, did they just cut our YouTube feed? And Michael assures me, no, no. Because he looks over and he looks at the local recording.
No. No, that's not true. But all right, go ahead. Well, I don't want to interrupt your narrative. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, somehow Michael just divined that they had. How did you? What
I was watching it on my computer on YouTube.
Really?
So it had not gone down when you asked.
So
me that.
Do you think that
and
someone?
I refreshed it.
I
refreshed it, and it was down, which I said 10 seconds later. Anyways, just go ahead.
So wait a second. Let me just see if I understand.
No.
Hold
up.
No, I don't need to speed it up.
Ugh. All right. I'm going to
slow
go to the
it
bathroom.
Down.
And you can monologue.
Well, let
right
me
back.
Just say what Michael obviously was saying, that even though we were getting IMs, that the YouTube feed had gone down. He's now left the room, ladies and gentlemen. Even though the YouTube feed had gone down, because obviously I got an IM about it, unless we had sort of a clairvoyant fan watching the YouTube feed, like I get the sense it's going to be shut down. On Michael's computer, the YouTube feed continued. As opposed to the other viewers, and then he refreshed it. He was not on YouTube. Let me take a poll. Matt, do you think that Michael was on YouTube checking the feed when he said no?
He did have his computer in front of him, so I don't know to the extent that that corroborates it.
Yes, he's sitting in front of his computer. That doesn't mean that the computer is actually pointed towards YouTube.
Right, but I'm just speaking as to what I can know here.
Right,
so I'm
okay.
Trying to give him some.
Fair enough. That's very nice of you.
I know what he was doing with his phone, which he was texting me saying that Kasich has lady hands.
Okay,
which
so
I had said that earlier, and he was confirming.
Okay, so here we go. Here is, let's let this video run now. Just cut our YouTube feed.
We freeze non-defense discretionary for 8 years.
Michael, are you sure?
No. We also put an increase in defense spending. Our tax cuts balance out.
Just,
no.
And at the end of the day, we will get to a balanced budget. And
all right.
I want everybody
just,
here to know.
When send people to the sound.
Chairman in Washington, I stepped on every toe in that town. And we got to a balanced budget and we had enormous job growth.
At Majority Report Live,
Ohio,
right? All right,
we
so we're just audio now.
Now,
remember,
to a gain
ladies and gentlemen, Michael had told us that
I'll
he had not touched anything.
I've done
and
it twice. I'll do
he,
it thrice
here he goes. He's now
America.
Reaching for his, he's reaching for the mouse and doing something on the feed. And then, as you can see, the reason why the sound is stopped is because the feed ended. So for some reason, he went over to the computer. And as he starts to move around the mouse and press with his finger, which you can see, then the video ends in a very strange way. So, in other words, ladies and gentlemen, the tale of the tape does not lie.
if I may say so.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
If it's any consolation, I did it on purpose. I just wanted to see if I could possibly get you to have a heart attack. But you handled it well.
I mean, not that much
of a tantrum.
No, I thought 36 seconds of, and also I did not, even though I knew you categorically were denying that you had touched the computer, and I knew that was very strange.
I was categorically denying touching the computer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I said, did you do anything? No, no, not at all. I didn't touch anything.
I did not do anything to stop the live recording.
You, in fact, did do something to stop the live recording.
Apparently.
What do you mean, apparently?
Apparently. The tape doesn't lie. So I've had to revise my statements based on conditions on the ground.
See, folks, I mean, this is basically, this is what happens. I mean, we're
going to
see this with Chris Christie. We're going to see this with other, we see this all the time with people who get indicted. And, you know, if I was an FBI agent, Michael would already be up on multiple charges of both, of basically just
wire fraud.
Of lying and wire
lying,
fraud.
Perjury. If you were an FBI agent, you would have gotten so brutally hazed at that agency. It would have been awkward. I can't see you fitting in as an FBI agent, Sam.
Well, you know, that's because I function here differently than I would at the agency. So, all right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half of the program. We just gave you a little taste of what happens in the fun half of the program. In today's fun half of the program, we'll also show Michael lying about whether or not he finished the jug of water in the refrigerator and the video that shows that he did. We're going to also whether or not Michael has been throwing paper towels on the ground in the bathroom and not picking them up. And we're going to show you the video that shows that he did. We have this whole office completely rigged with ongoing videos. See, now Michael's getting upset, so he's now throwing things.
What? I didn't throw anything.
All right. We have
is there tape of that?
Yes. We actually do have the camera on you right now. All right, folks. Remember, this show cannot exist without your help. We have all sorts of fees that we've got to pay for, things like, you know, paying for when, let's say, a big opportunity to play a video of the debate goes down. We cannot continue to do it without your help. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM the show. I'm setting up the IMs right now. Probably do a short fun half today because still those late night debates are not easy. I'm tired for days after that now. All right, we'll be right back after this.